Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning from Washington. Venezuela's leader, Nicolas Maduro, is facing an increased U.S. military presence off his shores and deadly strikes on boats the White House says are carrying drugs. We have a look at how he may respond. And we talk with a recently retired air traffic controller about the stresses of the job and what the flying public should know. Plus, Jane Austen fans celebrate the 250th anniversary of the author's birth.
She's like an exquisite choreographer of conversations and exchanges.
It's Sunday, December 7th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is defending U.S. military strikes on alleged drug cartel boats in the Caribbean. He said President Trump has the right to take military action as he sees fit. He spoke yesterday at a national security forum at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. Some members of Congress are concerned the military action may violate international law. One of them is Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I'm not drawing any conclusions here, because when you make the accusation about war crimes, that is a accusation once made cannot be retracted. But we are in those waters or in that area because, again, I think this constant, careless, sloppy approach from Pete Hegseth.
Warner has called on Hegseth to resign. He was interviewed on NPR. Russia has welcomed President Trump's new U.S. national security strategy, calling it largely consistent with Moscow's vision. The Kremlin spokesman said he hoped the changes in U.S. policy would guarantee they could work together for a settlement in Ukraine. The BBC's Danny Eberhard reports.
President Trump's national security strategy has much that will appeal to Moscow. Russia is now not labeled as a threat to the U.S., and the document says it's a core U.S. interest to negotiate an expeditious cessation of hostilities in Ukraine. Also, it aims to prevent NATO from becoming, as it put it, a perpetually expanding alliance. The strategy contains wording harshly critical of much of Europe, suggesting it faces what it calls civilizational erasure through migration and EU integration. The amended US security strategy set alarm bells ringing loudly in many European capitals. Some European politicians have questioned whether the US has now become more foe than ally.
The BBC's Danny Eberhard. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he won't withdraw from politics in exchange for a pardon in his corruption trial. He also says he expects negotiations over the future of Gaza to move forward soon. NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky reports.
Netanyahu was at a press conference with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz when a reporter asked about his six-year-long corruption trial. Would the prime minister leave public life if Israel's president grants his pardon request? He simply answered, no. Netanyahu also said he expects to meet President Trump before the end of the month and to discuss the next stage of a ceasefire deal with Hamas.
Second stage is achieved. We're about to finish the first stage. We're there, almost.
Israel still expects to recover the body of the last Israeli hostage, and Netanyahu said he also wants to talk to Trump about how to end Hamas rule in Gaza. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Dana Cronin. West Contra Costa Unified School District teachers say they made significant progress toward a deal in negotiations with the district yesterday. Teachers started an open-ended strike last week and held a candlelight vigil last night as talks were underway. Here's Francisco Ortiz, president of the teachers union.
Well, you know, it's been a hard and difficult last couple of days. And, you know, candles signify hope. We're hopeful that we can come to an agreement, and it's up to management to, you know, make that happen.
The teachers union says it's back at the bargaining table today to, quote, finish the job. The Teamsters union, which represents classroom aides, clerical workers, and food service staff, is also on strike and encouraging its members to hold strong. The district says negotiations yesterday lasted nearly 7 hours, and they'll provide an update on negotiations today. Drought conditions in California are improving, with only parts of the state's southern half abnormally dry, according to the latest U.S. Drought Monitor map. That's after heavy rains in October and November, and despite a lower-than-average snowpack so far this year. Andrew Schwartz is the director of the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab.
Even though we don't have a ton of snow yet, the rains made up for that a little bit, but we definitely want to see more snow start falling soon.
Schwartz says California ski resorts are starting to get anxious about the lower-than-average snowpack, but the 10-day forecast shows there's a chance of some snow in the Sierras. I'm Dana Cronin, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org. In KQED Food this week, our food editor, Luke Tsai, reflects on his favorite meals of the year, from pork chops in an Oakland parking lot to Lao food inside a Castro Valley bowling center. Find that at kqed.org/food. For the Bay today, mostly cloudy, areas of dense fog in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy and highs the 50s to mid-60s. Coastal flood advisory still in effect, that is set to expire at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Sacramento, widespread fog, locally dense in the morning, then patchy fog early in the afternoon, and mostly cloudy. Highs for the southern Sacramento Valley extending between 50 and 55.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump is ramping up the pressure on Venezuela's leader, President Nicolas Maduro, and has been for weeks now. He's sent warships to the region. The U.S. has carried out strikes on what it says are drug boats, and he's linked Maduro to drug trafficking. That's an accusation the Venezuelan denies, and Maduro is refusing to step down. Jimmy Story co-founded Global Frontier Advisors, a geopolitical advisory, after serving as U.S. ambassador to Venezuela under both the Trump and Biden administrations, and he joins us now. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
So President Trump has said that President Maduro's days are numbered. Do you agree?
I do. I guess fundamentally all of our days are numbered, but his in particular, after losing election.
Yeah,
of course. But after losing election by over 70 points last year, 70% of the people went out, voted him out of office. He's not a particularly beloved figure in the country. He's completely beggared the economy. He lost an election and he's involved with all this other kind of criminality and engagement with our strategic competitors. So I do think his days are numbered. Now the question is when that day comes up. I think that's what we're all speculating right now.
Well, how does that happen? Because I mean, even though there are experts who say that he lost the election, right? But he's still in power and he's refusing to step down. Do you think the U.S. is likely to carry out military action inside Venezuela to make that happen?
I think it's increasingly likely that some type of military action takes place. I do not believe that we have the resources in the theater for an invasion, but the president has at his disposal all of the resources necessary to do limited strikes inside of the country. Again, further pressuring Maduro to step down. I think the theory of change here has been that someone close to Maduro will ask him to seek an exit. Now, that'll be very difficult, especially considering which countries are engaged inside of Venezuela. And for Cuba, this is really existential. So the Cubans are not going to want to see Maduro leave the country or step down from power.
If the Venezuelan president is overthrown, does the U.S. have a plan for the day after?
Oh, that's a great question. And I've done a number of interviews over the last couple of months, and I'm like, listen, the second, third, fourth order effects are the most important here. Now, the Venezuelan people overwhelmingly voted for Edmundo Gonzalez last year, and they have the receipts. They showed the world the receipts. They actually got all the polling data from poll to poll to poll. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he can fly back in and take over on day one, and I do think that reinstitutionalizing the country is going to be a nonlinear process. You're going to have to keep the military because you have so many illegal armed groups inside the country, and you need to reinstitutionalize the country of 25 years of these institutions being undermined, right?
Well, is there now a need for an off-ramp for both sides?
Well, there's certainly a need for an off-ramp for Maduro. And I think that's something that under the first Trump administration we attempted, under the Biden administration we attempted via negotiations. Now the question I have is how much is the president going to want to invest in helping a post-Maduro Venezuela? I think that's a fundamental question. And like you asked, what is the plan?
Well, what would be the consequences for the U.S. if it once again orchestrates regime change in another country? And I mean, and dealing with the uncertainties that would come after that.
Well, let me start by saying that the Venezuelan people have already spoken. That's the first point of order, right? They've already voted him out of office. And the second is, we are suffering, the region is suffering through, and the Venezuelan people themselves are suffering through, the largest migration in the history of the hemisphere. 9 million people, 25% of the Venezuelan population has fled due to this dictatorial regime. So I think one of the questions to ask is, would it be better off without Maduro? Definitely. What is the plan for fixing the situation inside of Venezuela? It's going to be complicated, of course.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Venezuela, Jimmy Story. Ambassador, thank you so much for speaking with us.
We've had one of the most productive Congresses in the history of the institution.
That's House Speaker Mike Johnson on Fox Business Friday.
Now, remember, in previous years, speakers had 25, 30, 40-seat majorities. I have a razor-thin majority. I have to get every single Republican on most days, and so it takes a lot of work, but we're going to get there.
But the big question is where there is, and it's a question being asked increasingly among House Republicans. Liam Donovan joins us now. He's a veteran political operative who now heads up Targeted Victory, a Republican consulting and public affairs firm. Good morning.
Good morning.
So productive is in the eye of the beholder, but what odds do you give that Republican and Republican-leaning voters will see what the GOP-led Congress has done so far as productive in November?
Well, I think the productivity has been so front-loaded, which is leading to some of the frustrations late in this year, particularly coming out of the shutdown. But that's going to be the challenge of Republicans over this next year. And I think they understand that. I think Mike Johnson is aware of that. But they need to take the accomplishments of the first half of the year, particularly around the extension of the previous Trump tax cuts and the expansion on those, especially with respect to the provisions that people really do like, and as they learn heading into next year, remember things like no tax on overtime, no tax on tips, those sorts of provisions don't go into effect until next year. So as Americans start to feel the effects of those cuts, of those policies, and Republicans go out and run on those things, I think that's the best thing they have going for them. But remember, they benefited from the affordability conversation under Joe Biden.
And now they're suffering
exactly
from it now. But there is the issue of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, which seems to be a thorn for the GOP right now. Is there a deal that would be able to appeal to Speaker Johnson, pass the House, and also pass the Senate?
Look, this is a fraught issue that has really bedeviled Republicans for the last 15 years. And I think particularly if you think back to the first Trump administration, it was the first issue out of the gate that kind of that President Trump watched and I think recognized that this is something that is a little bit snake bitten for Republicans. So I think it takes some presidential leadership to be able to step up and give cover to Republicans to go do this. I think whatever the president decides, I think that will help kind of light
the
path.
Are you worried though? Because it does seem like whoever touches health care, they kind of get they face the repercussions. They face the wrath because it's a very complicated issue and it's hard to make everybody happy. So if you're the party making the changes, you may have to face the consequences.
Well, and I think that's right because this is a provision that was set set to expire by the previous Democratic Congress. And so the question for Republicans is, do they own this? Do they decide to extend it when they are now in power? I think where this is heading, it certainly seems like they're more willing to begin to get into the political game of whose fault is it that it expires, who set up the system that is leading to these increases in prices. But it doesn't look like there's going to be a deal. And so the question becomes, how does this next few weeks play out in a way that allows people to go run races and try to win elections on it in the next year?
Do you think the president's successful push to redistrict House seats in Texas, Missouri, and North Carolina, and the continued push for seats in Indiana, Florida, and Kansas, do you think that's a surefire way for Republicans to keep the House?
Well, I think it depends on that last bit, those remaining states. I think whether this effort was worth it will depend on how much that advantage stretches out as we go into Florida, as we go into Indiana. As it stands right now, I think it's mostly a wash and it ends up being a lot of money and a lot of heartburn over very little structural advantage. I think at the end of the day, we look back at those election results in November, that special election in Tennessee, you're not going to be able to draw your way into a majority position. You need to improve your standing. The president needs to be a little bit more popular. You need to get the mood of the country a little bit better around this economy. They have a year to
do
that.
I have to ask you, though, because the president is saying that affordability is a Democrat con job. How is that, you know, what are the Republicans who are running for office next year, how are they feeling about those sorts of comments?
I can tell you I don't think that'll end up in the ads that Republicans are running. I think that's, you know, the president is, you know, frustrated by the turnabout that we just talked about. But I think Republicans will have to run their races. They'll have to tout the things that I mentioned, the things that they've done while in Congress, and the things that really will help help Americans in their pocketbook, particularly as we head into tax season.
I need to preface this one with an acknowledgement that you've worked closely with Texas Senator John Cornyn, who's up for reelection next year. There are three Republicans running in the primary, which is just over 12 weeks away. The polls are very tight between Cornyn and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Does that mean that Cornyn is out of step with Texas Republicans?
No, I think this is just a continuation of what the Republican Party has gone through the last 10 or 15 years. I think the primary will play itself out. But I think the best thing that Republicans have going for them is the potential for an interesting primary on the Democratic side. As Jasmine Crockett comes in, I think every Republican in Texas around the country will welcome that addition to the race. And I think this will stay Republican in the end, no matter what. And it'll just be a distraction, I think, in the meantime.
That's Republican strategist Liam Donovan. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to NPR News.
The job of air traffic controller has been in the news a lot lately. How tough is that job? How stressful? Aisha Roscoe will speak with a former air traffic controller in the next segment of Weekend Edition here on KQED News. 818, Michael State, good morning. Hope you're having a great weekend, a great morning. Support for KQED comes from Peninsula Lively Arts, presenting Hip Hop Nutcracker, a spin on a holiday favorite with beloved music and fresh moves. December 20th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center. Details at PeninsulaLivelyArts.org. And European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and their bedding at SleepWorks.com.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. 3 days of talks between U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators wrapped up in Florida with no major breakthrough, but U.S. envoys say the process is moving forward. A fire swept through a nightclub in India just after midnight. Officials say 25 people were killed. Local authorities say most of the dead were kitchen workers, and the nightclub had violated fire safety regulations. and the Kennedy Center honors will be bestowed tonight in Washington. The honorees this year are Sylvester Stallone, Gloria Gaynor, George Strait, the English performer Michael Crawford, and the rock band Kiss. The host is President Trump. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
And it's quite something to see the members of the rock band Kiss all dressed up, not in their garb, but in tuxedos for that event. More on that event is coming up to you through the day here on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. Mostly cloudy, areas of dense fog this morning, then becoming partly cloudy on this Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. Highs for the bay today, the 50s to the mid-60s. Good morning, KQED, weekend edition time, 8:21.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Air traffic controller often shows up on list of most stressful occupations. And recent events haven't made things any easier. The government shutdown, when air traffic controllers missed two full paychecks, tragic plane crashes and near misses, and chronic understaffing. The Federal Aviation Administration is short more than 3,000 controllers nationwide. So what's the job really like? Emily Hanoka worked for the Federal Aviation Administration for nearly a decade, most recently at Reagan Washington National Airport. She left in June. She joins us now from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Emily, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You stuck with this job for more than 9 years. What did you like about being an air traffic controller?
Every day was different and the pace was always extremely fast. And that was something I really enjoyed. I left work and I could leave work behind me. And every day that I plugged in, every hour that I plugged in, the equation was different. And that was really exciting to me.
So what was the hardest part of the job?
The schedule. The schedule was definitely the hardest part. I think managing the schedule, managing home, and the hardest part was really just getting to work and being focused, being rested. Every shift meant that I was sacrificing time with my family. If I worked during the day, I usually left for work before anybody in my household was even awake. If I worked a night shift, obviously I'm missing bedtime with my three kids, and I'm coming home and everybody's already asleep. So every single shift for pretty much every controller, you're sacrificing some major aspect of family time.
I mentioned that you left in June. Why did you leave?
I loved being an air traffic controller, but the sacrifice with my family, we couldn't rationalize that anymore.
You were at DCA, though, in January when there was that American Airlines crash. That must have been hard. Did it change the job for you?
It absolutely changed it for me. I was not on schedule that evening. I worked a day shift the day of the crash and I worked the following morning. But it really did change a lot from my perspective. It was really hard. A lot of controllers that were on the shift when the accident happened, I don't expect they'll ever return to air traffic.
You hear a lot from regulators and from different lawmakers about how the different systems at the airports need to be updated. They need to be modernized. What was your view on that? How did that affect you?
Yeah, so I had the privilege of working at three FAA facilities, and those three FAA facilities had varying degrees of technology. I started my career in Jackson, Mississippi, and the technology we were using there was incredibly antiquated. We got a technology upgrade in 2019 there to a radar system that when I went to my second facility, they had had since the early 1990s. So technology is very, very slow to implement across all of the facilities within the National Airspace System.
There's been a lot of news or a lot in the news about understaffing at the FAA. How does that impact air traffic controllers?
It makes it more stressful. We also, I think, as a profession, have this sense of responsibility for the airspace. But for the past 10 years, when I got in the FAA in 2015, it's always been a staffing crisis. Staffing has not gotten any better in the 10 years since I've been a part of it. Controllers are taking on more and unfortunately not getting much out of it.
With the staffing shortages, what do you think could be done to get more people wanting to get into the industry?
I think there's a pretty good amount of people that want to join the workforce. The problem is how we onboard people. It's a slower process. The FAA Academy in Oklahoma City can only take on so many controllers and train them per year before they go to FAA facilities for live training. I think what could be done, though, is maintaining the controllers that are currently operational. I think now I've seen more people walk away than ever before, particularly people with my level of experience, about a decade, people halfway through their careers are walking away.
I imagine that you fly on occasion with your family. Do you feel like it remains a safe way to travel, or it will remain a safe way to travel if changes aren't made?
Oh, I absolutely believe that it is a safe way to travel. I stand behind getting on a plane every single day. The FAA does a great job of saying, hey, this facility does not quite have the staffing. And instead of making those controllers work more aircraft, they slow the equation down.
That's Emily Hanoka. She's a former air traffic controller. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jane Austen created stories that cause readers and viewers to swoon.
You have bewitched me, body and soul, and I love, and love, and love you. I never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
That's, of course, Matthew McFadden from the 2005 movie version of Pride and Prejudice. This month marks the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth. So NPR's Melissa Gray asked some of the writer's most ardent fans what they love about her work.
Where to find Austen enthusiasts? Not England, but Baltimore, where more than 900 members of the Jane Austen Society of North America gathered for its annual meeting this fall. To help them get into a Regency-era mindset, there were sing-alongs. Jewelry making, brooches with tiny portraits.
I love that you chose the eye. These are like lover's eyes. It was a fashion because you could wear your loved one and no one would know.
Also,
God save the king.
God save the king.
Since to be fond of dancing was a certain step toward falling in love.
Right hand star. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
50 people in two lines face each other, some in period dress.
Knowing your right from your left with your partners and knowing which way to turn, that was the biggest challenge.
But overall, pretty easy, says Tessa Herrings. She's a high school teacher from Phoenix, here with her friend Katie Yu. While Herrings was turning her body, her mind was turning to Pride and Prejudice, the 2005 movie, where Lizzie meets Mr. Darcy at a dance. He's rich, he's broody, he's a snob, the last man in the world whom she could ever be prevailed to marry. She rejects him. Her mother freaks out. Then, baby's sister runs off with a libertine. The family will be ruined. Mama's really freaking out now, so's Papa. Wait! It's Mr. Darcy to the rescue. He's not really a snob. No, he's a hero. Second proposal accepted. The end. Whew. Tessa Herring says her English students are receptive to Jane Austen, thanks in part to that movie.
They want to read Pride and Prejudice because they want to understand all of the memes and the jokes about Mr. Darcy and so on and so forth.
That particular movie, though, the big meme is about the boiled potatoes.
Yes.
What excellent boiled potatoes.
That's the unctuous would-be suitor, Mr. Collins.
Many years since I've had such an exemplary vegetable.
As Herrings and you point out, Austen's characters are archetypes. That's what makes them so relatable today. We all know someone who's awkward and ingratiating, like Mr. Collins, clever and independent, like Lizzie, or reticent and reserved, like Mr. Darcy. Dance instructor Tom Tumbush has read Jane Austen's books several times.
I advise young men all the time, read Jane Austen, learn how to dance.
And he knows what he's talking about, too. When he first began dating Tony, his future wife, she insisted they watch the BBC's adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. Yes.
the wet Colin Firth one. But
my favorite Jane Austen character is actually Mr. Knightley from Emma.
Mr. Knightley, a hard-working gentleman and magistrate who shows Emma where she's been wrong.
Modern men struggle to find good role models. Her heroes show how men can be men, do masculine things, make the world a better place.
And, he says, treat women with respect. Away from the general meeting now for views from two modern writers.
I didn't come to Jane Austen immediately. I came to Jane Austen eventually.
Author and poet Sandra Cisneros first read Austen decades ago. These days, she really appreciates the anxiety behind all those marriage plots.
There are all these issues of characters who are on the edge of poverty or living in poverty or fear of poverty in every single one of her books.
There's so much talk about debt and inheritance and who has it and who doesn't and whether someone has enough income to live independently or even comfortably.
And that's why women are so concerned about who they marry and how much each eligible bachelor makes when he moves into the neighborhood.
Jane Austen was an unmarried member of the gentry class, though on the bottom rung of it, as Cisneros writes in a new introduction to the vintage classics edition of Sense and Sensibility. When Austen's father died suddenly in 1805, he didn't leave much money for his wife and daughters. His sons provided some support. A well-off one eventually provided a cottage, but the household budget was tight. With few socially acceptable ways to earn an income, Austen turned to the writing she'd long shared with family and friends. She revised an old manuscript about two sisters named Eleanor and Marianne and got it published.
The family of Dashwood had long been settled in Sussex.
Their people of money, their gentility, and then they get pushed out, moved to a little cottage that a relative gives them out of pity.
How familiar. While Sense and Sensibility didn't make Jane Austen rich, it did sell, and more novels with satiric takes on class and human folly soon followed. All six novels are still selling today.
I think you ought to be made acquainted with Mr. Eliot's real character.
She's like an exquisite choreographer of conversations and exchanges.
That's novelist Brandon Taylor. He got hooked on Austen thanks to the audiobooks narrated by Juliet Stevenson. He loves how Austen uses language. It can be delicate and poetic, funny, as well as blistering.
Oh, he is black at heart, hollow and black.
Black at heart, hollow and black. A line I think about all the time. It's my favorite read a Jane Austen novel, maybe.
It's also from his favorite Austen novel, Persuasion. Anne Elliot was persuaded to reject the man she loved because he didn't have enough money. 8 years later, he's back. He's now Captain Wentworth, rich and single. But she's wilted. A spinster at 27, still. A second chance?
I think of it as being a book about what happens when you survive the worst decision you've ever made. It's like, oh, Jane Austen has provided me like a novel to teach me how to live with the after.
Austen completed Persuasion as her health was in decline. She died a year later at 41. The novel is melancholy at times, threaded through with regret and wisdom, a state well known to anyone who's hit middle age.
There's ever more thematic things at work in her novels that I discover. It's not like the book is shape-shifting. It's that I am now finally able to pick up what Jane Austen has always been putting down.
What are we looking at?
Back at the Jane Austen Society of North America's general meeting, Tam Painter of Lopez Island, Washington, flips through the Jane Austen Insult Guide for Well-Bred Women.
What strange creatures brothers are.
You are never sure of a good impression being durable.
That one is awful.
It's really bad.
Okay. The author's biting wit is only one reason Painter thinks these novels endure, 250 years after Jane Austen's birth.
There's a comfort to it. It's the comfort that you get from reading beautiful language, well-expressed ideas, but it's still going to have a happy ending. She's still going to get married at the end.
Anne will have her Wentworth, Emma, her Knightley, Lizzie, her Darcy. And we will have characters who are not just good company, but the best company. Melissa Gray, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Dana Cronin. West Coast health officials are bucking the latest move by the CDC and continuing to recommend that all newborns be offered the hepatitis B vaccine. KQED's Billy Cruz reports.
A CDC committee voted on Friday to end a long-standing recommendation to vaccinate all newborns against hepatitis B. Health officials in four states, California, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii, rebuked the move, saying it could lead to more people getting liver disease and liver cancer. The states issued their own recommendation as part of the West Coast Health Alliance, which was formed as a counterweight to federal vaccine guidance under the Trump administration. The CDC did not respond to a request for comment. I'm Billy Cruz, KQED News.
Many Bay Area residents say they don't want the Trump administration to start a war with Venezuela. KQED's Juan Carlos Lada reports from a rally in San Francisco.
With U.S. military vessels stationed near Venezuela and President Donald Trump threatening to attack alleged drug trafficking targets on Venezuelan soil, activists say they were compelled to mobilize. Fabian Fernandez is a local organizer and the son of a Venezuelan immigrant.
These are our taxpayer dollars that could be going towards food, education, housing, that are going towards an all-out war to enrich the billionaires of this country who want Venezuela's oil.
For their part, members of the Trump administration have insisted that this effort is meant to tackle drug trafficking originating in Venezuela, though many experts say most drugs in the U.S. are not coming through the Caribbean. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
And I'm Dana Cronin.
Coming up on Weekend Edition, more about tonight's Kennedy Center Honors in the nation's capital. The event's going to look and sound different from past years, and NPR's Elizabeth Blair will have an update just ahead on the program. I'm Michael State at 8:37. Time now for a listener perspective on KQED News. And the listener is Valeria Shinkarenko. Valeria shares about adjusting to life in the U.S. after she immigrated from Ukraine.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted and Franklin
migrated to the United States from Ukraine. It felt like entering a new world. Everything was different. The language, the educational system, even the way people greet one another. Immigration is always talked about as a journey, but for me, it felt like walking across a bridge that was being built beneath my feet. To succeed, I had to tap into the courage to take the initiative, patience to adapt to a new society, and determination to give back to the community that was now my home. Courage was the most important element for me at the beginning. Saying goodbye to friends, school, sports, and routines was terrifying. I remember the first day in an American classroom, unable to understand half of what the teacher was explaining and afraid to ask anything. This time, I learned that courage doesn't mean being fearless. It means moving forward even when you're scared. Then came the adjustment phase. Living in a foreign country is not just about learning a language, but about understanding a culture. I realized that blending in is not losing yourself. It's about combining your origins with the new environment, sharing Ukrainian cuisine with classmates, and joining community activities helped me slowly feel at home. The most rewarding part has been learning how to give back. Immigrants bring energy, creativity, and perspectives that improve society. Now I understand that immigration is not just relocation, but transformation. I arrived as a shy teenager and emerged stronger, more resilient, and determined to contribute to my community. Sharing these stories reminds others that immigrants are not outsiders, but neighbors working toward the same future. With the perspective, I'm Valeria Shinkarenko.
Valeria Shinkarenko is a college student who studies business administration. She lives in Pleasanton and says that she enjoys snowboarding and traveling across the United States. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and providing financial donations to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Weekend edition time is 8:40 at KQED News. Good morning.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Early voting is underway in Miami for a new mayor. Democrats are hoping to win the mayor's office for the first time in nearly 30 years. It would give them momentum ahead of next year's midterm elections. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky goes to London tomorrow to meet with European allies on negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine. He'll speak with the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany. And it's Christmas time in Bethlehem, which Christians revere as the birthplace of Jesus. A Christmas tree was lit yesterday for the first time in 2 years, previously canceled because of a ramp-up in military operations in the West Bank. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted Sabrina Carpenter and Franklin the Turtle, but despite our best efforts, not us. Join us for the apparently insufficiently provocative news quiz from NPR.
Wait, don't tell me begins this morning at 10 on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News. Now 8:42. Good morning.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. D-Day, 1944. Charles Norman Shea is a 19-year-old member of the Penobscot Nation, serving as an army medic as Allied forces stormed Omaha Beach. Shea left that day a hero. He died Wednesday at age 101. As Maine Public Radio's Caitlin Badayan reports, Charles Norman Shea was one of the first indigenous soldiers from that era to share his experiences.
Charles Norman Shea was awarded the Silver Star for going back into the water on D-Day to pull injured soldiers to shore, saving them from drowning. Shea had been drafted into the Army after the United States joined World War II. He was trained as a medic and transferred to the 16th Infantry Regiment, one of the three combat regiments of the 1st Infantry Division that spearheaded the Normandy invasion, later known as D-Day. In an interview with Maine Public in 2007, Shea recalled returning to the water.
I don't know how I ever did it. And I pulled several men up out of the water and to the safety of the, out of the water to the beach. I did what I could for them. I don't know where my strength came from, but I was able to save several lives.
Shea would later become one of the first indigenous soldiers to talk about his experiences in battle, said Harold Prince in an interview with Maine Public last year. Prince is the co-author of From Indian Island to Omaha Beach, the D-Day Story of Charles Shea.
Most people, when they go to American Indian reservations, they want to know about moccasins, tribal dances, shamans, you name it. But they don't really think about the fact that many of these Native Americans have traveled all across the world and fought across the world.
Shea re-enlisted after World War II and was later deployed in Korea before he retired in 1954 as a master sergeant. He was awarded France's highest award, the Legion of Honor, in 2007 and moved to the Normandy region of France in 2018, where he lived until his death on Wednesday. In an interview with Maine Public last year, Penobscot Nation Chief Kirk Francis said Shea is held in high esteem by his community.
I'm just proud of the ambassador that he is and the example he sets for people and how people look at Indian people in general. That's a guy that should be emulated.
A post on Shea's Instagram page says he died peacefully, surrounded by family. He was 101. For NPR News, I'm Caitlin Badayan in Bangor, Maine.
Tonight, picking up Kennedy Center Honors, Sylvester Stallone, George Strait, the rock band Kiss, Gloria Gaynor, and English actor and singer Michael Crawford. The gala in Washington, D.C. celebrates achievements in the performing arts every year. Stars saluting other stars often produces big, memorable moments, like when Carole King won in 2015. One of Carole King's biggest hits, performed by Aretha Franklin. This year's Kennedy Center Honors will be different from years past. And here to tell us more about that is NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Thank you for being here, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
So you've covered the Kennedy Center Honors for many years now. How is this award different from other entertainment awards?
A Kennedy Center honor is traditionally for artists who've made a major contribution to the performing arts. It's considered to be a prestigious lifetime achievement award that in theory has cultural gravitas. Past winners include people like Quincy Jones, Gladys Knight, George Clooney, LL Cool J, and Alvin Ailey. The format is that for each of the five honorees, other celebrities and artists show up to perform these tributes to them, either in speeches or songs. The honorees typically sit in the presidential box with the president and the first lady while these lavish tributes unfold on stage.
So it's a little like Hollywood on the Potomac. And I know the Kennedy Center has brought in some very big names to celebrate the honorees, like when Beyonce sang for Tina Turner or Alison Krauss for Dolly Parton. What are some of your favorite moments from past honors?
I have many favorite moments. When Yo-Yo Ma won in 2011, he was serenaded by James Taylor, John Williams, and a children's choir.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.
Another favorite moment is when Meryl Streep won. Emily Blunt was a total fangirl.
She actually has two jobs. The first is her own performance, which is always just breathtaking. And secondly is the task of stabilizing the other actor who is having a nervous breakdown because they're in a scene with Meryl Streep.
So in his second term, President Trump has gotten very involved with cultural institutions, and that includes ousting the Kennedy Center's previous leadership and becoming chair of its board. How has his takeover affected the Kennedy Center honors?
In a few different ways. In the past, the selection process took several months and involved a lot of different stakeholders. This year, it's really the President Trump show. He said he was 98% responsible for selecting the honorees. Something else that's different is that he will be hosting the event. Usually that job is left to people who are not the President of the United States. Previous hosts include Queen Latifah and Stephen Colbert.
President Trump said he was asked to host and then mused that he might give himself the honor. The honor is this rainbow-colored medallion.
That's what it has been in the past. It's a big change this year. The medallions used to be these bright rainbow-colored satin necklaces with gold nameplates. They were handmade by the same family since the very first honors in 1978. This year, there's a brand new medallion made by Tiffany & Company. It has a dark blue ribbon, and the rainbow has moved onto the medal itself. I mention this because in years past, the rainbow necklaces really stood out when you saw photos or watched the broadcast. You could easily identify which celebrities had won the awards because they all showed up proudly wearing these medallions.
Do we know who will be coming to Washington to pay tribute to this year's honorees?
We don't know, and that is not different from previous years. The Kennedy Center has always tried to keep the performers a secret. The look of surprise on the honorees' faces when they see who has turned out to pay them their respects has made for some really fun, poignant TV moments. But we do know a few performers who will not be there. Bonnie Raitt and Herbie Hancock, who have both been honorees and performers in the past, confirmed to NPR that this year their schedules won't allow them to come.
That's NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
The musician Sev Deliza had two albums under her belt and yet wasn't feeling accomplished.
Becoming a mother, being an artist that, you know, I wasn't making a lot of money. I was really struggling, to be honest. And I couldn't even support my family.
Spending time in the studio making new music helped Sev Deliza, born Sevda Elizadeh, regain her footing. And now she has a new album featuring the single Alibi.
I specifically aimed to make that song an anthem, and I started the demo while I had my six-month-old baby on my lap. What I wanted to do is I wanted to celebrate feminine power, but I also wanted to save myself from the situation I was in.
Sev Deliza's new album is called Heroína.
Basically, heroína, the way you spell it, it's the Spanish version of the word heroin. And I did like the wordplay that it's also derived from form of drugs, because I think that the mechanics of being an artist, the noradrenaline that rushes through your body when you're making music, the calm down after a show and when you're playing in front of 30,000 people, the highs and lows, the experiences you have are very similar to if you're addicted to something.
You also share some of your immigration story on this album. Can you talk to me about your early life experience, like moving to Europe from Iran?
Yeah. So I was born during the Iran-Iraq war. My earliest memories are really marked by instability and a kind of like an ambient fear. But when you grow up inside a crisis, you don't label it as a crisis. You just experience it as reality. And leaving Iran at 4 years old, I absorbed that disorientation of, you know, suddenly feeling foreign everywhere. It also really shaped my perception. And I do think that the qualities that I realized as an adult were actually trauma-born traits are the ones that really help me in life. I'm like super observant. I'm very intuitive. I'm always like watching my own back. And what's really interesting to me is that my identity has become so fluid because I am a refugee and I grew up in Rotterdam and I was exposed to so many cultures in so many countries.
You talked about being vigilant and kind of strength. You have this song, I'm Strong Because You Are. How does that capture some of maybe those feelings?
Well, Strong Because You Are was a song that I wrote for my mother. You know, when we came to the Netherlands, she was alone because my dad was still in prison. She really had to build up her life from scratch with a young child. As I became a mother, of course, I had way more privileges that she and my dad fought for, but I still had to go through similar experiences, traveling the world to create financial and career stability whilst having a young baby. It was quite difficult.
And when you say your father was in prison, was he in prison because of the Iran-Iraq war?
No, he was in prison because he was basically a political prisoner.
Once you got to Europe with your family, to Rotterdam, you got involved in sports and you became a basketball player. Did you find any connections between, like, you know, the basketball court and pop music?
I would say being a professional athlete in an environment that is not really inviting definitely set me up for being able to go beyond the grain and being able to deal with disappointment. Playing on the highest level is not easy. You know, some coaches like you, some coaches dislike you, some team members you don't get along with. You have injuries. It's really strange, but if you've done that on a high level, it's difficult afterwards to find your boundaries because you know you can mentally go over them.
Did you start making music after you were done with basketball?
No, I finished my university. I did my master's and my first job was at MTV, actually. That was my first introduction to the world of artists. And that's when I realized that I wanted to make music.
So you have strong religious imagery in your music. Talk to me about the song Messiah.
For me, religion is a very, very contradictive topic. I grew up in a country that oppresses women by deliberately using religion. So Messiah was born from a fantasy of centering the woman in religion, not shaming our sexuality.
It's putting all of that together, sexuality, womanhood, and putting women at the center. You have been through so much, and on this record, I know you've been talking about those struggles, but you also talk about, like, womanhood and what it means to be a woman today.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, my entire way of making music is a reflection of that, and also how I carry myself, how I make my decisions on everything. Feminine intuition, that kind of like womb energy, I carry that. Heroina for me reflects the kind of power that was born from survival. It's not the glorified cinematic version, but it's the quiet, persistent force you develop when life has stripped you down to your core.
Sev DeLisa, her new album is called Heroina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Aisha Roscoe and her team return with more of the program in the 9 o'clock hour. We'll have an update from NPR News and an update from Dana Cronin with KQED News just ahead as well. Support for NPR, it comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And support, comes from you, the listener, the sustaining member of the fan of KQED News. 8:58 on a Sunday morning, checking traffic beginning in the East Bay. Good morning, Gretchen Landcourt.
It's a crash for Pittsburgh. Highway 4, eastbound direction just before Bailey Road. Emergency units are on scene with this overturned pickup that's off the shoulder. The right lane is blocked while they work on recovering the vehicle. There's no backup for traffic, though. And for the San Mateo Bridge, westbound 92 at the toll plaza, an earlier crash into the toll plaza, still in the clearing stages, but it looks like they've cleared the left lanes. Traffic is back on the move over the span. Gretchen Landcourt for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Netflix presenting Cover Up from Citizen Four director Laura Poitras. With access to notes from reporter Seymour Hirsch, this documentary captures the process and power of investigative journalism. On Netflix, December 26th. Awards eligible. And support comes from East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org. This week on the Bay Curious podcast, have you ever noticed that old mansion tucked under the eastern span of the Bay Bridge? One listener did, and they want to know nearly everything.